to the race.
Let's go to the presentation from staff and Guff regarding potential commitment to the Ziegler-Guff Secondary Opportunities Fund.
We have a staff memo and presentation book for Ziegler-Guff. I'm just going to frame this and let Chi-Chi kind of walk through the exact underwriting of the strategy. The one question I want to address up front is why are we pushing presenting a private equity fund when we're also in the midst of doing the private equity advisor search? This just comes down to timing. The private equity advisor is probably not going to be identified until January or so. This fund is going to close by year end, so this was probably one of the last, if not the last, private equity fund we will do independent of the advisor. So just wanted to frame that discussion up front. And I'll let Chi-Chi walk through the exact fund details.
So this is a secondary investment. And for the newer trustees, secondary investment is different from the primary investment we usually do. Secondary investment already have investment that are seasoned, so you would have a less J-curve, and because you know more about the portfolio, so if you do a good job on the due diligence, your loss ratio will be lower. And that's why secondary investment have been very popular in the last couple years. And that's why we invest in the secondary investment, two of them with Adam Street. Jerry and Gabe, if you remember, we went to Adam Street conference,
yep.
And the secondary market is pretty tough right now. It wasn't like before.
Right.
In that a lot of money and capital flow into this market because the return profile was so good. So right now it's very competitive. If you look at the chart on page 3 of the staff memo, the pricing you will get, it's much higher right now compared to before. However, the investment that we are talking about today, that's not a regular secondary investment. It's a secondary investment focused on distressed and special situations. For example, there are a lot of headlines on investors bailing out hedge funds. So hedge funds, sometimes they have a side pocket on the private equity investment. So this investment vehicle is set up to do investment like that. It's complicated, nobody understands it. Very few firms can have the platform to do the due diligence. But Ziegler-Guff, because it was founded to do the investment on the distress funds, so it has all the network and database to track down this investment. A lot of times, the investment this fund did, they already have a primary investment in their database. So they know exactly what's in the fund. They know how to price the investment. And probably the next cycle, the distress opportunity will be coming from the private credit, because right now a lot of investors are getting into private credit. So this fund can be opportunistic to position itself to invest in the next wave of opportunities. And if you look at the impact on our portfolio, if you look at page 9, so if we do this investment, it would increase our distressed exposure to above double digit, and that is good. There are two areas in the private equity that have higher returns. One is venture capital, and we did that earlier with Adam Street Venture Capital Funds. That would give us access to a very high growth, probably one of the highest growths in our whole portfolio. And the other would be distressed. Distressed market would probably has the lowest entry point for our whole portfolio. So these two areas, we should always pay special attention to have appropriate exposure to them to generate higher returns. And like Tim said, it will take time to hire the private advisors, and it will take more time to come up with the plan. Meanwhile, we are moving the money right now to the liquidity portfolios, so it would be very helpful if we can have some private investment, especially something like this, secondary investment that is opportunistic, can give us instant access to the market so we can have exposure right now. Lastly, I want to talk about the risk of this investment. But before that, I want to pause for any questions.
We've got a lot of moving pieces on this one and throwing a lot of terminology out there, so I just want to make sure everyone kind of understands what we're looking at here and why. Any questions?
What's our general sense of, you know, without getting into the weeds of the numbers, of our co-investment experience with Singular?
We have a little bit co-investment that is under the small buyout, and we also have co-investment with their real estate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So my question is, what's our feeling about the experience? Has it been productive?
Yes, they already call some capital for their co-investment fund in Europe, taking advantage of the Brexit. So we did see the core capital from that fund.
But in terms of, we're still early days on this, so we haven't come through to full completion. So I think, you know, we're comfortable with what they've deployed. But until we see a realization, we can't, you know, come back to you and say,
right,
yep, this was a success.
But I mean, from a due diligence standpoint, from our perspective, I think the fact that there's a relationship with them, and the fact that we have a co-investment vehicle or two with them, speaks volumes to the trust that we would place in them to do this kind of investment on the
oh, absolutely,
kind of
yes, yes.
That's kind of what I'm driving at.
Obviously, we've got a not the longest term relationship with Singular Gup, but we've had a very productive relationship with Singular Gup. I think there's a strong alignment of philosophy across, you know, the firm with Cicera, and so we've done, you know, a separate account in the small buyout space, and we're able to shift the economics materially towards Cicera there, so drop the cost dramatically. We've done a couple of rounds on the real estate fund. Now we're taking a look at, you know, actually going up to a derivative strategy of their flagship. Their flagship has always been distressed investing, and now we're saying, you know, within distressed, we're taking a look at the secondary piece because there's not, as Chi-Chi said, there's not a lot of buyers in the secondary market for these distressed and special situations funds. They're just too complex. So you need a firm that actually has the distress capabilities at the top level there. And, you know, not a lot of buyers leads to an inefficient marketplace, and we're seeing an entry point here.
And Scott, the relationship goes mutual. For this fund, it was overly subscribed. And because we are very busy right now internally with so many projects going on, so when I found out this project and to have it to go through the new procedure, really onerous burden team put on us, you know, this really takes a lot of time to prove it out internally first. So I talked to them and see if they can extend this. So they went out to their LP just for us to get the extension from the end of September to the end of this year. And they are investor waiting to get in for this fund.
Chi-Chi, we went to Adams Street. You mentioned it earlier, and they introduced a secondary markets fund that they were starting up, and they wanted to, you know,
right,
get clients for. We've got great relationships with both Adams Street and Singular Gup, and have history with both. In your analysis of the two secondary markets, do you feel this one is a better market for us to go into?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And compared to the new one that Adam Street is providing?
Yeah. In fact, Adam Street just announced the head of their secondary investment is leaving the firm because he couldn't make the commitment to the new fund they are raising. Yeah. So, you know, I'm glad you brought it up. It's a sharp contrast.
Yeah.
The pricing is so full, and it's very hard to make money. I mean, you make money based on the good investment you have. But before, you also make money by entering the investment at low price. And right now, that advantage is gone.
Right.
Chi-Chi, by referencing a specific name, Tony Cusano, on key man risk.
Yeah, that's where we are going next. Yes.
That clearly highlights how important he is to it.
Right.
What would happen if that proverbial bus hit him?
They would cease the investment.
They would cease at that point?
They would cease calling
the... So uninvested monies at that point...
Yes, stay with us.
...would be returned?
Yeah.
Or not drawn?
Not called, not being called.
Well, actually, you in the memo, I thought that the key man provision was stated in the alternative. It was either Tony or it was Drew and George, right?
There was another person mentioned.
Yeah, the key man is written as both George Sigler, Andrew Guff, or Tony Cassano.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
But in this scenario, the bus scenario, the investment stops.
That will trigger it. Tony itself will trigger
it. So if Tony were leaving, it would trigger the key man provision.
Okay.
Yeah. They just can't allow to all be on the same bus.
I may have read that too quickly. I thought they were. It was stated in the alternative.
Frequently, the founders are always.
Yeah. Yeah. We tried to summarize it here.
Okay.
Clearly, the key man provision, as written in the LPA agreement, is a paragraph long and lays out exactly what we want to see. But we're just trying to give you the synopsis here. Maybe we didn't convey that quite appropriately.
No, that's probably just because I didn't take enough time to read it.
And to further discuss the work we did in this area, I had a very candid, detailed, confidential conversation with the firm's COO, and we talk about Tony's compensation structure, different structure they put in place to keep him at the firm. Some of the clause I wouldn't be able to talk about it here, but my feelings out of that phone call is he has a good setup right now. He needs the firm's platform and resources as much as the firm needs him. So for fund one, I don't see him leaving the firm. For next fund, or if there is a next fund, we don't know, because this is very highly opportunistic. I don't know. But at least for this fund, I don't see him leaving. The fund is already invested. So he's very busy right now.
Jerry?
The sense I got reading this thing, obviously they're extremely complicated, and I don't pretend to understand what they're doing, but it almost sounds as if some of that complication is enough for current holders to lay off their package. Sigler Guff picks it up, and then they can and often do lay off pieces of it.
Yeah.
That were too complicated for somebody else to deal with. That Macau thing was interesting. I mean, they bring in a whole hedge fund package, and then they lay off pieces, including I'd never seen the expression side pocket before. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have no idea what that means, but I get the sense that it's laying it off to somebody else.
There's a show on cable TV network called Storage War. So it's like someone goes to a storage, and you can bid on the stuff inside the storage. But you cannot open it, right? You can only bid by looking at it. But this, you can go in and open it and take a look. So there's a huge, sharp difference just by being able to take a look at the unwanted stuff in that storage. So this is sort of like that.
I was wondering how long it would take you to use that analogy.
Not a bad one.
I have one more. You're asking for $50 million on a $300 million investment.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage is that of that investment?
16.
About 16%?
16.
Okay. Does that fit within our investment policy?
Yes. The policy talks about aggregate commitment levels at the top line, so not at the fund level, but at the organization level, and we're well within that. I think within the growth allocation, we have a maximum of, just approved this, but 8%.
So I'm talking about the investment in one fund. We're within that.
Absolutely.
All right. That's just want to make sure we're.
Yeah.
And if we can do more, I would love to do more to 75. Just like what we did at the Adam Street Venture Innovation Fund, but unfortunately, this is oversubscribed.
On the fees, there's 1% on committed capital,
And then 1% on capital invested after that.
So it's 1% throughout.
So we state, okay, we'll make a $50 million commitment. As soon as we say that, then they start charging the management fee.
So right now we pay 1% on $50 million. But after investment period, they charge 1% on the invested capital. So it's 1% throughout, but the base is different. But given the structure of this fund, very quick deployment, I would think we pay 1% on $50 million.
Okay. So during the investment period, they're saying they're going to ramp it up. We expect the investment period to be pretty brief here. So, yeah, we're going to pay the management fee on our commitment. Once it exits the investment period, it's fully ramped up, and they start selling off, then we're paying 1% on that declining base, not on the same $50 million throughout the life of the fund.
And on that note, we come in at cost, but the fund is marked up to 1.3x right now. But we can still come in at cost. So after we come in, we get 30% jump right away. And that's after the fees we pay. So that 30% is net. But of course, it's not realized.
Yeah. So this is us hunting for attractive entry points in a market that's not offering a lot of attractive entry points, which is why we're bringing it to you here.
Right. And like you asked question, Dr. Madalo, last time, is this common? It's not. Usually, even the secondary fund, you go in with a blind pool. You don't know what kind of the secondary fund they will buy. But right now, you already know. I think it's $80 million already committed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So 80 out of 300, that's pretty high. It's just like the real estate transactions you saw last time. But this is not common. This is rare.
Jerry?
I'm prepared to make a motion to...
I don't think we're ready for the motion
yet.
Oh, the presentation.
We have the presentation.
No, tell them to save the airfare. It's too late.
We can send them home. That's fine.
No, we better not do that. I forgot. They weren't on
the agenda. See if they can talk us out of it.
I thought since we'd already heard them once before.
So any question before I bring them in?
Thank you, Gigi. Good report.
Thank you.
Just ready to go home already.
No, they've been
home
before.
Your first out of the box, and
no,
that way. Good morning. We are getting a quick coffee refill, and as soon as everyone has returned, let me ask you to introduce yourselves and make your presentation.
Sure.
Great. Whatever way you'd like.
I was going to say that. Sounds good. Thank you.
Gabe. And David.
David.
Oh, okay. And here's Gabe.
Ready? Is everyone here?
We're good.
Yes, go ahead.
Great. My name is Matt Brewer. I'm responsible for client service and marketing for Singular Gough on the West Coast. I'm joined by George Singular, who's our founder and chief investment officer, and Tony Cusano, who's the portfolio manager of our Secondary Opportunities Fund. I'll turn it over to George in just a minute to sort of walk you through why he personally decided about this opportunity, why we decided to launch a fund business off of it, and then Tony can walk through more of the details. But I wanted to start by thanking you for the support that you guys have given us over the years in small buyout real estate strategies. Both businesses are doing quite well, and we very much value your partnership there. And we're very excited about this particular strategy, which Tony will walk you through in just a minute. But George, if you just want to spend a couple minutes kind of talking about how you feel about the space and why you're excited about it.
Good. It's good to be out here again. You know, we have a great long relationship with the organization, and it's always kind of pleasant to have this weather and come out to California. I was actually out here a week ago as well, went back and came back and such. Those of you who heard me before, I've been at this now for 43 years. I started doing it in the early 1970s for the Harvard Endowment and worked there for 10 years before I went on to be in government and other things. And in private investing, you always try and find an edge or an advantage. And one of the best edges you can find is an involuntary seller. When somebody, for regulatory reasons, for policy reasons, for whatever, has been instructed to do something that doesn't necessarily generate the best price, but they have to do it anyhow, it's good to try and be on the other side of that. And over the years, our firm has taken advantage of that by being a large investor in distressed assets, and have done well with that for our investors. As I say, I go back so far that I remember literally buying the bonds of the Penn Central Railroad, which went bankrupt in 1972 and took about 8 years to work out. And people who bought those bonds or real estate or other things out of that restructuring did well. And so we've made a large career. We've done over $5 billion of those kinds of distressed assets. Mostly in the U.S. Most recently, we've taken advantage of some of the real estate and watched a strong recovery. U.S. real estate has recovered in most markets back to pre-crisis levels. But along the way, there were banks and others that had to sell assets. The private equity industry, when I started, was raising less than $1 billion a year for the whole industry. Now that's a medium-sized fund. And literally trillions of dollars have been invested over the last 20 years in private equity. For the most part, generating positive and incremental returns, beating generally on average the stock market and the bond market. And that's something I think will continue going into the future. As distressed assets happen, they happen at different sectors and different points in time. We mentioned real estate. They happen with high-yield bonds. We all remember back the collapse of Drexel Burnham. We can think back as far as the RTC days with the collapse of the savings and loans. In one sense, one of the big sectors now is things related to energy. As prices of energy have fallen, there's a fair amount of restructuring to be done. But there's also an interesting category that we've taken advantage of people who own certain types of private equity assets who, for various reasons or another, have to sell. So they're going to be selling their fund interest in the secondary market. And within that market, which has now grown to be a $30, $40 billion a year transaction activities, we've always focused in on the area where there were distressed types of investments in secondaries that we could invest in. Tony Fasano has been on our team now 6.5 years, originally West Coaster, came East, and within our distress team began this process of identifying a number of years ago these secondary opportunities of managers we knew something about or funds where the net asset value was considered, if it was 100, we could buy these things for 75 cents on a dollar, 80 cents on a dollar, get liquidations and create extraordinarily good returns. And over the years now, we've done a large number of it, and we're continuing to find more and more available supply at very attractive rates of return. So within our distressed activity, Tony has built out a team that has been quite successful and is raising a dedicated fund that will be $300 million. We're essentially fundraising is over. This will be the last commitment if you guys are good enough to vote for us. And the fund will have, by the time it closes, probably have 40% of the assets already invested and an embedded gain. So I think that it's an exciting time and an interesting activity. Tony supervises three other investment professionals. The activity is near and dear to my heart. His office is next door to mine, and so there's not a day that goes by that I haven't stuck my head in and say, what are we bidding on? What's new coming in? We started this fund a year ago literally with the firm putting up the initial capital because we had deals in the pipeline we wanted to have in the fund. So before we had an official close, we put in our own capital and bought a number of things. We've closed capital throughout the year and deployed it over the year. And as I say, I think we'll have let Tony tell the story of the kinds of things we bought and the kind of returns we're generating. But in an era where zero interest rates are the norm and where people are being challenged by their actuarial assumptions, we think this is a place that we can generate some extraordinarily high returns. So, Tony?
Yeah, great. Thank you for having us. I thought we'd start on page 7 of the presentation. Hopefully everyone has that in front of us. Just frame the market. As George mentioned, the broader secondaries market has grown to about $49 billion of equity transactions per year in this space. But if you look at the map, the vast majority of it all transacts on the left there in buyout private equity. And that's because that's most of what private equity is buyout, and then there's real estate. Distress is kind of a small sliver of this whole market. So there's a lot of groups chasing the bulk of this market, the buyout space. I mean, there's literally over 40 different groups doing that. And some of these groups are now raising $10 billion funds because you can scale that business. The part of the market that we're in, which is in the middle here, special situations, credit, and distressed, it's not scalable. It's a sliver of this market with massive inefficiency and lack of competition. And so what happens is we see some of these groups on one-off names. Like there might be a group that likes Oak Tree, but they don't like anything else in distress, or they don't buy anything else in distress. So when we go into looking at deals with sellers, oftentimes their choice is us or holding it. And that's a good situation for us, because if they want to sell, we're either the only game in town or there's us and one other person, which creates pricing pressure, which allows us to buy things at higher returns. And the reason that's the case is because there's higher barrier to entries in doing underwriting on distress and credit. It's a lot harder to get access to information. It's harder to underwrite. And because of the platform George built, you know, we have over 10 years with our flagship business, $6 billion investing in this space. We know all these managers. We either have money with them, or we met them when they were market raising money. And chances are we've met with them either way in the past year. So we have calls into their analysts saying, what is this credit? What's the thesis? What's the underlying fundamentals? So that's what really gives us our edge in the space. And that's kind of what differentiates us versus all the other secondary players I think you see out there. The last point I want to make in the slide, though, is that the other thing that differentiates us, which is I think everyone will be doing over time but isn't today, is that we're a buyer and a seller. So when we buy something, we're buying it at 25% returns. When we find someone else in the market to take that from us at below 10% returns, we'll sell it. If we don't find anyone, we'll hold it to maturity. Every deal is underwritten to hold until the end. But if we find someone early who's willing to buy from us at a lower return, we'll take it, we'll sell it to them, and we'll reinvest that money in something else at a higher return. So we're not just buy and hold.
What point does somebody want to buy from you? What makes that position all of a sudden to market for?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it can be a lot of different things. Sometimes it's situations where we're buying wholesale and then selling retail. We'll buy a big package of stuff, and then we'll part out names that someone else wanted, but they didn't want the whole package. In other situations, we'll buy something where no one understands the underlying fundamentals of a manager. And once we've accumulated a full position, we'll go educate the market.
Pretty woman.
So it's in that situation, those tend to be really big spreads. We did a deal in the end of 2013, bought at 71. We went and educated the market and sold it for 97. We made a $30 million gain in about a year. So either of those situations is how it happens. Page 8. So specifically what we're doing within the distressed market. There's kind of three legs of the stool. On the right there, these are kind of side pocket liquidations. And these are situations where a fund is raised originally to have liquidity for its clients. So you expect to be able to get your money out of this fund within 30 or 90 days. But some event occurs that forces that fund to gate. And what that means is that you get your money when they sell things. You no longer have the ability to call them and say, give me my money back. So you never signed up to a fund that originally, you didn't sign up to a fund that was illiquid. You thought you could get your money whenever you wanted it. Turns out you can't. That's where we come in. So we step in and say, okay, well, we'll give you liquidity. It's at a different price, which is a lot more expensive, but if you need liquidity, we'll give it to you. That part of the market is really interesting. It's a smaller part of the market, though,
And most of these funds came about in 2008, so it's kind of a melting ice cube. As they sell assets, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. We think there'll be more of these created, though, over the next 5 years. And these are some of our highest returns in this part. So this would be 15, 20% of the fund. The middle part, which is the bread and butter of what we do, these are the distressed fund managers that everyone in the room probably knows some of the names. These are the Oak Trees, excuse me, the Angelo Gordon, the Avenue, Mountain Patterson, Sun Capital. They're kind of the right down the middle of the fairway private equity names. We're in most of them. The ones we're not in, we've known for a really long period of time. We know all the underlying assets, and we're kind of routinely pricing these. Literally every month we have prices on that whole market. So that's the bulk of what you'll see in here. That'll be 70% of this fund will be in those names. And then there's the Fallen Angel component, which is these are managers where they originally set out to do something that was not distressed, the strategy, and then they later became distressed. And when that happens, the original investors who didn't sign up for a distressed fund, who now all of a sudden are in something distressed, won out. And now it would be like bank recaps, for example. Prior to the crisis in 2008, there was a bunch of funds that were raised to recap community banks, and then all of a sudden every one of those community banks became distressed. And that's where we step in. So that's the kind of three legs of the stool, kind of 15 to 20%, and kind of around 70, plus or minus.
Tony, do you have any, you indicated the bank circumstance was 2008.
Yeah.
Any more recent ones as good examples?
Yeah, you see these themes within distress come about, and sometimes they're real opportunities, and other times they're GPs that realize another GP just raised money under that marketing pitch, then they take on the marketing pitch, and these things come about that aren't real opportunities. Like a good example was European distress in 2012 and 13. Every pitch from the distressed portfolio manager at that point in time was saying banks are going to be forced sellers across Europe. It's going to be 2008 in the U.S. Now in 2012. So they raised billions of dollars for the opportunity that never happened. So now you're in that fund, and you thought you were going to get a 20, and you're getting an 8. And you've never given that group money for anything before that, and you'll probably never give them money again. So when you go to rebalance your portfolio, they're on the chopping block. Another example is energy. You know, energy a couple of years ago is billions of dollars raised for it. And there wasn't an opportunity then. And everyone who invested that money has done really poorly. But now today there is more of an opportunity. But all those funds that were done prior to this most recent downturn are going to be in the market. So those are a couple of them.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Slide 10, this is the track record. And this track record dates back to 2010, when we did our first secondary. This is every single deal. There's no cherry picking. This is everything we've done. If you look in the bottom right corner and go one to the left, the 51.8 IRR and a 1.42x multiple, and all the way to the bottom right, that 73%, think about that as a DPI. That's the percentage of the capital we deployed that's already come back. So 73% of the track record was realized. So a lot of times when people show you a track record in secondaries, they're buying something at a discount, they mark it up, and you see this eye-popping IRR because it's over such a short period of time. But there's no realizations. So, I mean, that could change pretty significantly. In this case, though, it's 73% realized. So it's firmed up quite a bit. When we model this to full liquidation, we think the IRR is in the mid-40s, and the multiples in the 1.5 range. So I think that's what you'll see on this portfolio if we just kept it static and let it run off.
You're combining the secondary investment funds with the non-secondaries to get to that 73. If just looking at the secondaries, they're lower numbers, and the 73 overall is obviously influenced by the earlier non-secondary funds. Any distinction in that we ought to recognize?
You mean as far as the newer deals have lower returns?
Yes. In terms of you in part focused on 73%.
Yep.
Okay. 73. Yeah, if
saying.
You just look at the column.
Yeah.
Okay. A good part of how you get to 73 is in the earlier investments right. that yeah, are non-secondary.
Right. It's because the newer deals, they take time to have realization. So the older deals have largely worked out at this point, and so I think you'll see realizations coming out of this portfolio literally monthly. And these more newer numbers will go up over time. But those are newer deals, so you would expect the distributions to be lower until they're more seasoned.
These are only secondary investments, right?
All secondaries. Okay. Every secondary we've done is the INR. It's across three different vehicles, though. So this is Distressed Opportunities Fund 4, which was our kind of flagship business that does fund-to-funds and other things. It can also do secondaries. All the deals from that are in here. Fund 3, all the deals from that are in here. And then a separate account we did with New Mexico Teachers is in here as well, including all the investments that are now in this fund that you're buying into. All secondaries across the whole platform, all here. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, basically it jumped out to me. Obviously, we're looking at a secondary fund.
Yep.
The primary historical information I would think we'd want to look at is secondary, and we combined the two. Obviously, overall, it's incredibly impressive.
Thanks.
No question.
Well, let's talk about what's in this actual fund that you're buying into. That's the most relevant, and that's on page 11. So we've done seven deals. When you come in, if you decide to come in the last close, you actually buy into all these investments at cost. You have to pay the 8% back to the original investors for having borrowed their money for a year. But the investments are marked at a 1.33x. And we've already realized, that's in the bottom right corner. Of the $60 million we've deployed here, we've already realized $26 million of cash back. So you're investing in a portfolio that's largely de-risked. And then on top of that, we've deployed another 20 that's closed subsequent to this date. I believe this performance is off of June. So since June, we've closed another 20. So $80 million invested of the 300 we're raising. And in the past 2 weeks, we are either have cut or are very close to cutting deals on another $70 million. So, you know, to George's point earlier, we think by the time the final close happens, this will be 40-ish percent invested. And then we have 3 years from that point to continue investing and recycling. So off to a really good start and kind of a unique opportunity to buy into this at cost. That's where things stand.
You just want to walk through one example that sort of ties other concepts together?
Yeah, sure. Let's do the biggest one, investment number 5. So actually, I think we have a slide on this. 17. So this is a situation where we originally met this particular seller in 2012. And what this was is a platform in Europe, an asset management platform, where they'd gone out to literally thousands of high net worth individuals and sold them private equity. So given high net worth individuals the opportunity to invest in private equity when they otherwise couldn't meet the minimum check for most of these people. So they did this in 2006 and 2007. So probably the worst time, actually the worst time to be doing this. So in 2008, a bunch of these high net worth individuals came back and said, hey, I want my money back. They had offered liquidity as part of this program. They immediately shut the gates and said, we can't give your money back. But you'll have this illiquid side pocket, and every time there's a sale in the underlying assets, you'll get a check. And so in 2012, 4 years later, folks had gotten back kind of 80% of their original money, and there was still 20% of the original money left, plus a bunch of it had appreciated, so there's even more. So this asset manager approached us and said, would you come in and offer everyone liquidity so they can leave if they want? We took a look at the opportunity, and we just couldn't get comfortable that there was enough of these people that wanted that to warrant the 6 months of due diligence that my team would have had to have spent doing this to come up with a price. So we walked away. One of the largest secondary groups came in and actually called us 3 days before bids were due and said, hey, we have a direct line to the seller here. We know that of all the side pockets that they're trying to get liquidity on, there's 12 of them. There's one that they can't find someone to bid on. And we happen to be in every name in that one side pocket. So we came back in. We offered liquidity for it. We invested $30 million. Today it's a 1.46x deal. And we went our way. 2015 came around. The same group called us and said, hey, you're really easy to work with. We know you know these names well. Help us design a process to offer everyone who didn't sell liquidity. And this time, the only difference is going to be that if someone doesn't respond, so if you get this solicitation to sell your interest and you don't reply, you're a forced seller. And so we thought that was really interesting because that means a lot of these people didn't respond a lot of the time before. So we went through, we underwrote the portfolio. It was a lot of Cerberus and other kind of special situations funds that we knew really well. We were in all of them. We offered liquidity to 1,400 high net worth individuals here, and we got hit with $73 million of actually equity. So it was $120 million of assets. And within 3 weeks of us getting that deal, I turned around and sold $12 million of the 30 that the fund got. So the fund took 30 of the 73, this fund. Sold 12 for a 14-point spread of what we bought it for to de-risk the rest of what we owned. And today, we've gotten back about $17 million of the 30 on this deal. And we closed this deal in March. So that kind of shows you the velocity of capital. And the returns today on this are 1.21. We think it'll end in the 1.3 range, but it'll be a very short hold period. So the IRR is extraordinarily high. But again, it was, we knew all the managers, we had access to information, good relationship with the seller, and the folks that were selling were motivated because they'd been stuck in this since 2008.
Question, Tom. Sure. For the relatively good investment in the portfolio you bought, you sell them quickly. What about the other, you know, I don't want to use not so good investment, but
like the tail?
Yeah, the portfolio. What's your plan on that?
Sure, yeah. It's a mix of quality assets and then some less quality assets that are left. I think what we'll do is we'll wait for the quality assets to play out. Once those are out of the portfolio, there'll be a natural tail of assets, and it'll be small relative to the amount of money we deployed. We're constantly in the market trying to sell that once the good assets are gone. So at some point we'll sell it, and we'll sell it when the returns on a go-forward basis are kind of less than what we're willing to accept, which is 10%. So once someone's willing to buy from us that tail, less than 10% returns, we're going to sell it and wrap this deal up.
But when you bought the portfolio, you know all the assets, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yep, absolutely. We've underwritten all the underlying assets.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to take you back to page 10 and about the middle of the page. I believe it's Investment Fund 14 SOF. For Q3, it says 0% realized. What happened in that it didn't
happen? Yeah. So this transaction is somewhat unique for us because this is the lowest return transaction we've had across the whole portfolio, and we still didn't lose money here, and I'll walk you through what happened. So this deal is an Oaktree fund. It's an Oaktree European fund.
Oaktree.
Yeah, Oaktree. And the biggest position in that fund is called Countrywide. Countrywide in Europe is the is their largest broker, real estate broker. It's like
central. Not this Countrywide.
Wait a minute.
So Countrywide is a brokered business in the UK. We bought into that. It's a public stock. We bought into it at about a 40% discount to the public trading price, which was about 5.3 times free cash flow, which was extraordinarily cheap. And then Brexit happened. And obviously the probability of Brexit happening and what anyone would have told you at that time was low. We thought we bought at a big enough discount to preserve our capital if it happened. And it turns out we did. But again, we priced this to Brexit not happening. And now it's just going to extend the hold period. So we're still going to make money here. It's just instead of being a 1 to 2 year hold, it's going to be more like a 3 to 4 year hold. And I think we got a little bit more.
So how much longer are you going to be with that fund?
Well, we underwrote this to maturity, so I think we're going to hold this. Actually, we're trying to buy more of this name right now. We think it's a buy right now where it is. So we're going to be in it for several years.
So another 2 to 3 years or?
Probably more like 3 to 4 years.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think the IRR will be lower than what we originally underwrote because, again, we underwrote to 25 in kind of 2 years. But given the Brexit hiccup, I think it'll take us longer. We'll get a lower IRR, but a good multiple.
Okay. And meanwhile, you have people, analysts, looking into these stocks.
Absolutely. We've met with the management of Countrywide twice in the past 3 months. Mm-hmm. When they're in New
Repeat
York.
Repeat that, please.
We've met with the
management
of Countrywide, the public company in the UK,
yes,
twice
yes.
In the past 3 months.
Okay.
So we have a direct line to management here, and we know everything that's going on at the company. Everything is public, at least. Happy to answer any other questions if there are any.
On the term sheet, or are you going to go ahead? You're going ahead to...
Oh, terms? Sure.
Happy well, that's okay. No, I just if you're going to get there, otherwise I've got a question on that.
Yeah, sure. Happy to go there now.
Yeah. I just wonder if you'd expand a little bit on the clawback provision that's listed down there.
Clawback. Yeah, this is a situation where...
He's clawing back from whom?
It'd be a situation where it's just a traditional kind of standard term in a private equity doc where essentially if you took carry and then you ended up not getting carry overall, you'd have to give back the carry you took.
To you?
To you, to the investors.
So there's protection for limited partners.
Exactly. Yeah, because if there's no clawback, then someone could essentially take carry on a really good deal and then lose money on the fund and never pay it back, which is unfair to investors. And so just timing on the fund. So we set out to raise 250 target. The hard cap, which is set by New Mexico Teachers, is 300. We're going to hit 300, and we should be wrapping this up over the next month or two.
I hope that you understand. I mean, Tony and his team know more about this space than I think anybody there. I mean, it's the intensity of effort that really creates a set of opportunities. It's the networking, it's being on the phone, it's being the intermediary there. It's a niche market in a bigger market that shows the inefficiencies we can exploit. Tony's team is deep. For us is a modest amount of money. Our firm manages $12 billion. There are four full-time people, professionals dedicated to this. As I say, Tony's office is next to mine, his team's right next to him. We find it one of the best opportunities out there today, and so we've put a substantial amount of the firm's capital in it as well. We are near the end of the period, so there's visibility on about a third of the money already, and it's been quite successful. The effort has been successful since it started 6 years ago, and I see no reason why it won't continue. I think that as we talk to our clients, lots of people got over their skis in private equity in the global financial crisis, particularly endowments. I was with the head of the Cornell Endowment, and they are 47% of their assets are locked up now that they have no liquidity, and they've got uncalled capital equal to almost a third of the portfolio. So they brought a new CIO in, and he's looking at how does he get liquidity. And we had a large European insurance company that 2 weeks ago had basically liquidating out their private equity portfolio. And I think we've won that. We've got the bid there and signed and waiting for their signatures to come back. So we will exploit this space as we can. As I say, I think that the unique relationships are what we're all about in this space. And these returns should be, on a return IRR basis, quite high. On a multiple basis, they're short duration holdings, so you know, over the life of the fund, it probably will double your money. But you know, if I look at the world we're in today, and I just don't see the Dow Jones at 36,000 anytime soon. Interest rates are zero, and the world is still going to be kind of a messed up place for a while, I think. Any questions?
Yeah, Anthony, how long have you been with Singular Glyph? 3 years, 4 years?
No, six and a half.
Six and a half years?
Yeah, I joined in June of 2010.
How long do you think you're going to be around?
A long time.
Yeah?
You mean just in general or at Singular Glyph? No, I plan to be there for a long time. I made a sizable commitment to this fund.
I don't want to look at us going into this and then 6 months down the road, suddenly you're off to another company or another firm.
No.
That has happened in the past and
yeah.
It didn't sit well.
If he was, I don't think we'd be the first ones he'd tell.
So. Huh?
And look, I think from my perspective, like I said, I put a sizable commitment of my net worth in this fund. I think I'm the third largest individual at the firm who's in this besides George, who's a pretty different net worth than me. So I'm going to be around to manage it.
I think, and obviously we structure ourselves to be what's good for the client and what's good for the firm. So Tony is extraordinarily well incentivized, I think. But also, if he left, he couldn't never talk to you guys again for the rest of his life or a lot of other things. So there are great rewards and a few pretty powerful sanctions that sort of lock us in together for a long time. I think we're...
Yeah, most importantly, I'm happy. I love coming to work every day. I handpicked everyone on my team and all those friends. So.
George, I hope you stick around for a few more years, too.
I mentioned I was out here last week. I'm on the board of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and I got to have lunch with George Shultz, who will be 96 in December.
Whoa.
And so I asked him what was on the schedule. He said, well, I'm flying to MIT to give a talk next week, and then I'm going to go do this, and I want to see the fall foliage. And I thought, I intended, this is what I've done. This is fun. There was an interesting piece in The Economist this past week about the private equity industry and obviously the much larger firms, and sort of pointing to the fact that the fellows at KKR are 73 now, and the team at Carlyle are in the late 60s. Steve Schwartzman from Blackstone and I were classmates in business school. I think it's a business where, my idol is Warren Buffett, and I think he's 83, and Charlie Munger is 92. So I think I'll be at this for a while.
Good. You were at the Reagan administration, right?
I was. And I will not be in the Trump administration, I assure you.
For any number of reasons.
I could have said that even a year ago. it will be a very interesting election and an interesting outcome. George Shultz told me, I shouldn't tell in this room, he told me he's voting for Hillary. And he didn't come out publicly to say that, but I asked him, and he just said, I hope there's a lot of room full of Trump supporters here. I have a lot of sympathy for the domestic issues that makes Trump a phenomenon, and I think that the economy has not served all its citizens very, very well. Unfortunately, I think that the things that could be fixed are going to be hard to do. I mean, the estimated cost of regulation is 10% of GDP. It's almost $2 trillion a year.
God damn.
And you just look at it and realize what's going on. And, you in our small buyout portfolio where you invest, I mean, the managements are just dealing with so much additional regulation. Our legal department, which you guys don't pay for, it comes out of our fees, has gone from 1.5 lawyers to 5. We've never had an issue. We've never had anything. Not a single page of this can be sent to you until a lawyer's reviewed it. And that's the world we live in right now. I think that, I can't understand why housing hasn't recovered. You talk about millennials and their lifestyles, but it has never been a cheaper time to buy a house. I mean, you're sitting with 3% 30-year interest rates, and to get people into homes and own them, and it's still kind of the bedrock of people's sort of financial stability, just hasn't recovered. And banks can't lend money, or the procedures and regulations are difficult. But I think we will. I'm optimistic that, presuming Hillary's elected, things will still get better. That I think that she'll be a more pragmatic president, and policy-wise, will be more of a growth agenda. So,
even with Elizabeth Warren pulling her further to the left,
I
thought it was Bernie.
I think we will. It'll be very interesting to see. I don't think that she has. I mean, her power is over. There's nothing Elizabeth Warren. Hillary doesn't owe Elizabeth Warren anything, really. When you really look at the demographics of this election. And as I say, I think that, if we look and measure her and her husband's administration, I look back on it, and pretty good times. And, there was a great historic accident in the first Clinton administration, which was Bob Rubin. And I'm no fan of Goldman Sachs, I assure you. But Bob Rubin understood capital markets and was brought in, and he spent his first 2 years just on White House staff. He had that National Economic Council, and then became Secretary of Treasury, and understood what the markets would do if you let them work. And as a consequence of that, we had pretty rational policy for a good period of time. So the notion that Elizabeth Warren can name Secretary of Treasury and the head of the SEC, I think is I just don't think it'll happen.
It's a scary thought.
And I also think that Hillary will be much better at working deals with the Hill than Obama did, in terms of just understanding that compromise is what it takes to get stuff done. And there are lots of things where I think, you know, you'll have a wing of the Republican Party along with Democrats to get some legislation passed. I think we're going to address the immigration problem and solve it, or solve it a lot better than we have, as a matter of course. So I'm, you know, the only thing I feel bad about is the stock market's not cheap. And so, you know, we are going to face, hopefully, a return someday to real interest rates set by real markets. And that may, as interest rates move up, have an adverse impact on markets. But I think the economy is going to grow a lot faster than 1%.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? I think we're all done. Thank you very much.
Still time, Jerry.
Take any questions from the trustees. One thing I want to